Chewing on her cookie, Mrs. Threadgood looked down at the floor. "You know, Evelyn, I hate a linoleum floor. This place is just full of ugly gray linoleum floors. You'd think with so many old people out here running around in their felt slippers that are prone to slipping and sliding and breaking their hips, they'd put down some rugs. I have a hooked rug in my living room. I made Norris take my black tie-up shoes down to the shoe shop and get me a rubber cat's paw sole put on them, and I don't take them off from the time I get up until the time I go to bed at night. I'm not going to break my hip. Once you do that, it's goodbye, Charlie. These old people out here are all in bed by 7:30 or 8 o'clock. I'm not used to that. I never went to bed before the 10:22 Atlanta passed my house. Oh, I get into bed by 8 and turn out the lights so I won't disturb Mrs. Otis, but I can never get to sleep good until I hear the 10:20 blow his whistle. You can hear it all the way across town. Or maybe I just think I hear it, but it doesn't matter. I still don't go off until I do. It's a good thing I love trains, because Whistle Stop wasn't never nothing more than a railroad town, and Troutville was just a bunch of shacks with one church, the Mount Zion Primitive Baptist Church, where Sipsy and them went. The railroad tracks run right along the side of my house. If I had me a fishing pole, I could reach out and touch the trains with it. That's how close I am. So I've been sitting on my glider swing on the front porch for the past 50 years, watching those trains go by, and I never get tired of looking at them, just like the raccoon washing the cracker. I like to look at them at night the best. My favorite thing was the dining car. Now they just have a snack bar where people sit and drink their beer and smoke their cigarettes. But back before they took the good trains off, the 740 Silver Crescent from New York on its way to New Orleans would pass by right at supper time. And oh, you should have seen it. With the colored waiters dressed up in their starched white jackets and black leather bow ties, with the finest flatware and silver coffee pots, and a fresh rose with baby's breath on each table. And each table had its own little lamp with a little shade on it. Of course, those were the days when the women would dress in their finest, with hats and furs, and the men looked so handsome in their blue suits. The Silver Crescent even had little tiny Venetian blinds for each window. There you could sit, just like you were in a restaurant, rolling through the night. I used to tell Cleo, eating and getting somewhere at the same time appealed to me. Iggy always said, "Ninny, I think you ride that train just to eat." And she was right, too. I loved that porterhouse steak they used to serve. And you've never had a better plate of ham and eggs than what you could get on the train. Whenever the train stopped in those small towns along the way, people would sell the cooks fresh eggs and ham and fresh trout. Everything was fresh back then. I don't cook that much anymore. Oh, I'll heat up a can of Campbell's tomato soup now and then. Not that I don't enjoy a good meal, I do, but it's hard to find one nowadays. One time, Mrs. Otis signed us up for this Meals on Wheels program they got down at the church, but they were so terrible that I just stopped them from coming. They may have been on wheels, but they weren't anything like the meals you could get on the trains. Of course, living so close to the tracks had its bad side. My dishes got all cracked, even that green set I won when we all went to the picture show over in Birmingham during the Depression. I can tell you what was playing. It was "Hello, Everybody" with Kate Smith. She looked at Evelyn. Now, you probably don't remember her, but she was known as the Songbird of the South. A big, fat girl with a good personality. Don't you think fat people have a good disposition? Evelyn smiled weakly, hoping this was true, since she was already on her second bag of Lorna Doones. But I wouldn't take anything for the trains. What would I have done all those years? They didn't have television yet. I used to try and guess where the people were coming from and going to. Every once in a while, when Cleo could scrape together a few dollars, he'd take me and the baby on the train, and we'd go as far as Memphis and back. Jasper, Big George and Onzel's son, was a Pullman porter at the time, and he'd treat us like we were the king and queen of Romania. Jasper went on to become the president of the Brotherhood of the Sleeping Car Porters Union. He and his brother Artis moved to Birmingham when they were very young, but Artis wound up in jail 2 or 3 times. It's funny. You never know how a child will turn out. Take Ruth and Iggy's little boy, for instance. Having to go through life like that could have ruined some people, but not him. You never know what's in a person's heart until they're tested, do you? Whistle Stop Cafe, Whistle Stop, Alabama, June 16, 1936. The minute Iggy heard the voices outside by the tracks, she knew that somebody had been hurt. She looked out and saw Biddy Louise Otis running for the cafe. Sipsy and Onzel had walked out of the kitchen just as Biddy threw open the door and screamed, "It's your little boy! He's been run over by the train!" Iggy's heart stopped for a moment. Sipsy threw her hands up to her mouth. "Oh, Lord Jesus!" Iggy turned to Onzel, "Keep Ruth in the back," and started running over to the tracks. When she got there, the 6-year-old boy was lying on his back with his eyes wide open, staring at the group of people who were looking down on him in horror. When he saw her, he smiled, and she almost smiled back, thinking he was all right, until she saw his arm lying in a pool of blood 3 feet away. Big George, who had been out in the back of the cafe barbecuing, had come running right up behind her and saw the blood at the same time. He picked him up and started running as fast as he could toward Dr. Hadley's house. Onzel was standing in the door, blocking Ruth from leaving the back room.
"No, now, Miss Ruth, you can't go. You just stay put right here, sugar."
Ruth was scared and confused. "What's the matter? What happened? Is it the baby?" Onzel took her over to the couch and sat her down and held her hands with a death grip.
"Hush, sugar. You just sit here and wait now, honey. It's going to be all right."
Ruth was terrified. "What is it?" Sipsy was still in the cafe, wagging her finger up to the ceiling.
"Don't you do this, Lord. Don't you do this to Miss Iggy and Miss Ruth. Don't you do this thing. You hear me, God? Don't do it."
Iggy was running right behind Big George, and they were both yelling at the house 3 blocks away, "Dr. Hadley! Dr. Hadley!" The doctor's wife, Margaret, heard them first and came out on the front porch. She spotted them just as they came around the corner, and she shouted for her husband, "Get out here quick! It's Iggy, and she's got Buddy Jr." Dr. Hadley jumped up from the table and met them on the sidewalk with his napkin still in his hand. When he saw the blood spurting from the boy's arm, he threw the napkin down and said, "Get in the car. We've got to get him to Birmingham. He's gonna need transfusions." As he was running to the old Dodge, he told his wife to call the hospital and tell them they were coming. She ran inside to call, and Big George, who was by this time completely covered with blood, got in the back seat and held the boy in his arms. Iggy sat in the front seat and talked to him all the way there, telling him stories to keep him calm, although her own legs were shaking. When they arrived at the emergency entrance, the nurse and the attendant were waiting for them at the door. As they started in, the nurse said to Iggy,
"I'm sorry, but you'll have to have your man wait outside. This is a white hospital."
The boy, who hadn't said a word, kept watching Big George as they took him down the hall and until they turned the corridor out of sight. Still covered with blood, Big George sat outside on the brick wall and put his head in his hands and waited. Two pimply-faced boys walked by, and one snarled over at Big George.
"Look, there's another nigger that's got hisself all cut up in a knife fight."
The other called out,
"Hey, you better get yourself over to the nigger hospital, boy."
His friend with the missing front tooth and the crossed eye spit, hitched up his pants, and swaggered on down the street. The Weems Weekly, Whistle Stop Alabama's Weekly Bulletin, June 24, 1936. Tragedy strikes in front of cafe. I am sorry to report that Idgies and Ruth's little boy lost his arm last week while playing on the tracks in front of the cafe. He was running alongside of the train when he slipped and fell on the tracks. The train was traveling about 40 miles an hour, Conductor Barney Cross said. He is still over at the hospital in Birmingham, and although he lost a lot of blood, he is fine and will be home soon. That makes a foot, an arm, and an index finger we have lost right here in Whistle Stop this year. And also the colored man that was killed, which just says one thing to us, and that is that we need to be more careful in the future. We are tired of our loved ones losing limbs and other things. And I, for one, am tired of writing about it. Dot Weems. Rose Terrace Nursing Home, Old Montgomery Highway, Birmingham, Alabama, February 23, 1986. Mrs. Threadgood was enjoying the Reese's peanut butter cup that Evelyn had brought and reflecting back to what seemed to be her favorite period, the time when all the trains were running past her house. But something she had said the week before interested Evelyn, and her curiosity got the better of her. "Mrs. Threadgood, did you say that Idgie and Ruth had a little boy?"
"Oh, yes, Stump. And you never saw a more manly little fella, even when he lost his arm."
"Good Lord, what happened?"
"He fell off one of the trains and had his arm cut off right above the elbow. His real name was Buddy Threadgood, Jr., but they called him Stump, 'cause all he had left was a little stump of an arm. Cleo and I went to see him in the hospital, and he was just as brave, didn't cry, didn't feel sorry for himself. But then Idgie raised him that way, to be tough and take hard knocks. She went over to see her friend who owned the tombstone place and had him made up a baby tombstone that had carved on it, 'Here lies Buddy Jr.'s arm, 1929 to 1936. So long, old pal.' She put it out in the field behind the cafe, and when he got home, she took him out there, and they made a big to-do about having this funeral for his arm. Everybody came. Onzel and Big George's children, Artis and Jasper, little Willie Boy and Naughty Bird, and all the neighborhood kids. Idgie had some Eagle Scout come out there and play taps on the bugle. Idgie was the first one to start calling him Stump, and Ruth near had a fit, said it was a mean thing to do. But Idgie said it was the best thing, so nobody would call him anything about it behind his back. She thought he might as well face up to the fact that he had an arm missing and not be sensitive about it. And she turned out to be right, because you never saw anybody that could do more with one arm. Why, he could shoot marbles, hunt and fish, anything he wanted to. He was the best shot in Whistle Stop. When he was little and there was somebody new in the cafe, Idgie would bring him in and have him tell this long, tall tale about going fishing for catfish down on the Warrior River, and he'd get them all caught up in the story, and then Idgie would say, 'How big was the catfish, Stump?'
And he put out his arm, like the grown fishermen used to do to show how long the fish was, and he'd say, "Oh, about that big?" And Iggy and Stump would laugh over the expressions on the people's faces, trying to figure out how long that fish was. Of course, now, I'm not saying he was a saint. He had his little temper fits, just like the other little boys. But in his whole life, the only time I ever knew him to complain or be upset is that one Christmas afternoon when we were all sitting around the cafe, drinking coffee and having fruitcake, when all of a sudden he started carrying on like a crazy person, just a-mashing up all of his toys. Ruth and Iggy went in the back room where he was, and in as little time as it takes you to say butter the biscuits, Iggy had him in his coat and out the door. Ruth was upset and worried and ran after them and asked where they were going, but Iggy said, never mind, that they would be back in a little while. And sure enough, they were back in about an hour, and Stump was laughing and in a good mood. Years later, when he was down at my house cutting my yard, I had him come up on the porch and handed him a glass of iced tea. I said, "Stump, do you remember that Christmas when you got so mad and stomped your erector set that Cleo and I gave you?" Well, he just laughed and said, "Oh, Aunt Ninny," that's what he called me. He said, "Aunt Ninny, I sure do." I said, "Where did Iggy take you that afternoon?" He said, "Oh, I can't tell you, Aunt Ninny. I promised I wouldn't." So I still don't know where he went. But Iggy must have said something to him, because he never worried about his arm being missing again. He was the 1946 champion wild turkey hunter. And do you know how hard it is to shoot a wild turkey? Evelyn said no, she didn't. "Well, honey, let me tell you, you have to shoot those turkeys right between the eyes, and their heads are no bigger than my fist. Now that's a good shot." He even went on to play all kinds of sports. Never let that arm stop him in any way. And sweet, you never met a sweeter boy. Course, Ruth was a good mother, and he adored her. We all did. But Stump and Iggy were special. They'd take off hunting or fishing and leave us all behind. They enjoyed each other's company more than anyone else, I guess. One time, I remember, Stump put a piece of pecan pie in his pocket and ruined his good pants, and Ruth was just a-fussing at him, but Iggy thought it was the funniest thing in the world. Now, Iggy could be rough with him. She was the one that threw him in the river when he was 5 and taught him how to swim. But I tell you one thing, he never sassed his mother like some boys will do. At least not when Iggy was around. She just wouldn't allow it. Not at all. No, sir. He minded his mama, not like Onzel's boy Artis. They couldn't do a thing with him, could they? Evelyn said, "I guess not," and noticed Mrs. Threadgood had her dress on inside out. Whistle Stop, Alabama, Christmas Day, 1937. Almost everyone in town had gotten a cap pistol for Christmas, and most of them had gathered in Dr. Hadley's backyard that afternoon for a shootout. The whole yard smelled of sulfur from the caps that had been cracking in the cold air all afternoon. They had all been killed 100 times over. Pow, 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 you're dead. Pow, pow, ah, you got me, ah. 8-year-old Dwayne Kilgore grabbed his chest, fell to the ground, and took 3 minutes to die. When he had jerked his last jerk, he jumped up and unrolled another red strip of caps and reloaded in a frenzy. Stump Threadgood was a late arrival to the shootout and had just finished his Christmas dinner up at the cafe with the family and Smoky Lonesome. He hit the yard running, and he had timed it just right because everyone was loaded and ready to go. He ran behind a tree and took aim at Vernon Hadley. Pow! Pow! Crack, crack, crack! Vernon, who was behind a bush, jumped up and yelled, "You missed, you dirty varmint!" Stump, who had shot all his caps, was busy trying to reload when Bobby Lee Scroggins, an older boy, ran up to him and let him have it. Crack, crack, crack! Pow, pow, pow! Gotcha! And before he knew it, Stump was dead. But Stump was game. He reloaded time and time again, only to be killed in the process, over and over again. Peggy Hadley, Vernon's little sister, who was in the same class as Stump, came out all bundled up in her new maroon coat with her new doll and sat on the back steps to watch. All of a sudden, it wasn't so much fun to be getting killed over and over, and Stump started desperately trying to get one of them. But there were too many of them, and he couldn't reload fast enough to protect himself. Crack, crack, crack! Killed again. But he kept trying. He made a desperate run and got behind a big oak tree in the middle of the yard, where he could dart out and shoot and jump back behind the tree. He had already killed Duane with a lucky shot and was working on Vernon when Bobby Lee jumped up behind him from behind a stack of bricks. Stump turned, but it was too late. Bobby Lee had pulled two guns on him and let him have it with both barrels. Crack, 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 crack. Bobby Lee shouted, "You're dead! You're double dead! Die!" Stump had no choice but to die in front of Peggy. It was a quick, quiet death. He got right up and said, "I've got to go home and get some more caps. I'll be right back." He had plenty of caps, but he wanted to die for real. Peggy had seen him get killed over and over. After he left, Peggy stood up and yelled at her brother, "Y'all aren't playing fair. Poor Stump has only one arm, and that's not fair. I'm going to tell Mother on you, Vernon." Stump ran in the back room and threw his cap pistol across the floor, and then kicked his electric train set against the wall, mad and crying with frustration. When Ruth and Iggy came back, there he was, stomping his Erector set that he'd already smashed flat. When he saw them, he started crying and screaming at the same time. "I can't do anything with this thing!" And he began hitting at his missing arm. Ruth grabbed him. "What's the matter, honey? What happened?"
"Everybody's got double holsters but me. I can't beat 'em. They've killed me all afternoon."
"Who?"
"Duane and Vernon and Bobby Lee Scroggins,"
Ruth said, stricken. "Oh, honey." She knew this day would come, but now that it had, she didn't know what to say. What was there to say? How do you tell a 7-year-old boy that it would be all right? She looked to Iggy for help. Iggy stared at Stump for a minute and then got her coat, picked him up off the bed, put his coat on, and took him outside to the car. "Come on, mister, you're going with me."
"Where are we going?"
"Never mind." He sat there in silence while she drove him down to the river road. When they came to a sign that said Wagon Wheel Fishing Camp, she made a turn. Pretty soon they came to a gate made out of two big white wagon wheels. Iggy got out and opened the gates and then drove on through down to a cabin by the river. When she got there, she blew the horn, and after a minute, a red-headed woman opened the door. Iggy told Stump to stay in the car, and she got out and went up to talk with the woman. The dog inside the house was beside itself, jumping up and down, yapping. It was so excited to see her. Iggy talked for a few minutes, and then the lady went away for a second and came back and handed Iggy a rubber ball. When she opened the screen door, the little dog flew out and was about to wiggle itself to death, so glad to see her. Iggy walked down off the porch and said, "Come on, lady, come on, girl," and threw the ball up in the air. The little white rat terrier jumped at least 4 feet and caught the ball in midair, and then ran back to Iggy and gave it back to her. Then Iggy threw the ball up against the house, and Lady jumped straight up and caught it again. That's when Stump noticed that the little dog only had 3 legs. That dog jumped and ran after that ball for about 10 minutes and never once lost its balance. After a while, Iggy took the little dog back up to the house and went inside to say goodbye to the red-headed woman. Then she came back out to the car and drove down a little road where she parked by the river. "Stump, I want to ask you something, son."
"Yes, ma'am."
"Did that dog look like it was having a good time?"
"Yes, ma'am."
"Did it look like she was happy to be alive?"
"Yes."
"Did it look to you like she felt sorry for herself?"
"No, ma'am."
"Now, you're my son, and I love you no matter what. You know that, don't you?"
"Yes, ma'am."
"But you know, Stump, I'd hate like the devil to think that you didn't have any more sense than that poor little dumb dog we saw today." He looked down at the car floor.
"Yes, ma'am."
"So I don't want to hear any more about what you can and can't do. Okay?"
"Okay."
Iggy opened up the glove compartment and pulled out a bottle of Green River whiskey. "And besides, your Uncle Julian and I are going to take you out next week and teach you how to shoot a real gun."
"Really?"
"Really." She removed the bottle cap and took a swallow. "We're gonna make you the best goddamn shot in the state, and just let one of them try and beat you at anything. Here, have a drink."
Stump's eyes got big as he reached for the bottle.
"Really?"
"Yes, really.
But don't tell your mother. We'll make those boys wish they hadn't got up in the morning."
Stump took a sip and tried to act as if it hadn't tasted like gasoline on fire, and asked,
"Who was that woman?"
"A friend of mine."
"You've been here before, haven't you?"
"Yeah, a couple of times.
But don't tell your mother."
"Okay."
Birmingham, Alabama, Slagtown, December 30th, 1934. Anzel had told her son Artis over and over again that she did not want him going over to Birmingham, ever. But tonight he went anyway. He jumped off the back of the freight that arrived at the L&N terminal station at about 8 o'clock. When he went inside, his mouth dropped open. The station seemed as large to him as Whistle Stop and Troutville put together, with its rows and rows of thick, rich mahogany benches and the multicolored tile that covered the floor and the walls of the huge building. Shoe shine, sandwich counter, cigar stand, beauty shop, magazines, barber shop, donuts and candy, cigarettes, whiskey bar, coffee, bookstore, have your suits pressed, gift shop, cold drinks, ice cream. Here was a city, teeming with redcaps, porters, and train passengers, all under the 75-foot glass ceiling. It was all too much for the 17-year-old black boy in overalls who had never been out of Whistle Stop. He thought he had seen the whole world inside that one building, and he staggered out the front door, dazed. And then he saw it. There it was, the largest electric light sign in the world, 20 stories high, with 10,000 golden light bulbs glowing against the black sky. "Welcome to Birmingham, the Magic City." And it was magic. Billed as the fastest-growing city in the South, and even now, Pittsburgh was being called the Birmingham of the North. Birmingham, with its towering skyscrapers and steel mills that lit up the sky with red and purple hues, and its busy streets buzzing with hundreds of automobiles, and the streetcars on wires whisking back and forth day and night. Artis walked down the street in a trance, past the St. Clair, Birmingham's up-to-the-minute hotel, on by the L&N Cafe and the Terminal Hotel. He peered in between the Venetian blinds on the window of the coffee shop and saw all the white men sitting there enjoying their blue plate specials and knew that this was not the place for him. He made his way past the Red Top Bar and Grill and over the Rainbow Viaduct on by the Melba Cafe, and as if by some primeval instinct, he found Fourth Avenue North, where all of a sudden the complexion began to change. He had found it. Here it was, those 12 square blocks, better known as Slagtown, Birmingham's own Harlem of the South, the place he had dreamed about. Couples began moving past him, all dressed up, talking and laughing on their way to somewhere, and he was being pulled along with them, like a white cap floating on the crest of a wave. Music throbbed out of every door and window and spilled down flights of stairs into the streets. The voice of Bessie Smith wailed from an upstairs window, "Oh, careless love, oh, careless love." Hot jazz and blues were melting together as he passed by the Frolic Theater, which boasted to be the finest colored theater in the South, featuring only musicals and high comedy. And the people kept on moving. Down the block, Ethel Waters sang and asked the musical question, "What did I do to be so black and blue?" While next door, Ma Rainey shouted out, "Hey, jailer, tell me what have I done?" And people in the Silver Moon Blue Note Club were doing the shimmy sham shimmy to Art Tatum's Red Hot Pepper Stomp. He was here, Slagtown, on a Saturday night, and just one block away, white Birmingham was completely unaware that this exotic sepia spot even existed. Slagtown, where the Highland Avenue maid of that afternoon could be tonight's Queen of the Avenue, and redcaps and shoeshine boys were the leaders of Slagtown's after-dark fashion show. They were all here, with black shiny patent leather slick hair and gold teeth that glistened and sparkled as they passed under the colored lights that flashed and traveled around the signs. Blacks, tans, cinnamons, octoroons, reds and dukes mixtures moving artists down the street, all dressed in suits of lime green and purple, sporting two-toned yellow and tan brogans and thin red and white silk ties, while the ladies, with gleaming deep maroon and tangerine lips and swinging hips, were promenading in spectator pumps and red fox furs. Lights blinked away at him. The Magic City Billiards Parlor for Gentlemen, the St. James Grill, Blue Heaven Barbecue, Alma Mae Jones School of Beauty Culture. On past the Champion Theater, where happiness costs so little, 10 cents. Two doors down, he saw dancing couples through the window of the black and tan ballroom, where amber spotlights lazily searched the room, turning the couples a pale purple as they floated by. He turned the corner and was carried along, faster and faster, down the teeming street, past the Clouds of Joy used clothing exchange, the Little Delilah Cafe, Pandora Billiards, and the Stairway to the Stars cocktail lounge, advertised as the home of the mixed drink, and the Pastime Theater, this week featuring Edna Mae Harris in an all-colored review. Next door at the Grand Theater, Mary Marble and the Little Chips were appearing. He went on by the Little Savoy Cafe, past more dancing couples silhouetted through the windows of the Hotel Dixie Carlton Ballroom, with its large revolving mirrored ball shooting silver sparkles of light all over the room. Foxtrotting couples inside were unaware of the young black boy in overalls, wide-eyed with wonder, being swept by the Busy Bee barbecue shop for ladies and gents that offered electrically cooked waffles and hot cakes at all hours, and your favorite sandwiches, toasted, served with the best coffee in the city, hot dogs for 5 cents, homemade chili, hamburger, pork, ham, Swiss cheese sandwiches, all for a dime. Pass the Viola crumbly over the Rainbow Insurance Company, which specialized in burial policies, with a sign in the window that urged her potential customers to get a lot while you're young. On by the deluxe hotel and rooms for gentlemen. Near the casino club at the Masonic Temple, a large-breasted beauty behind him, resplendent in a corn-colored satin dress, wearing a lemon-yellow feather boa, squealed and flung her purse at a fleet-footed gentleman and missed. The gentleman laughed. An artist laughed, too, as he continued on down the street with the crowd. He knew he was home at last. Slagtown News, Flotsam and Jetsam, Birmingham's sepia newspaper by Mr. Milton James, May 6, 1937. Mr. Artis O'Peavy was admitted to the University Hospital late Saturday evening, suffering from multiple self-inflicted accidental injuries he received while attempting to open a particularly expensive bottle of wine, his female companion said. The year and the label unknown. Is it just my imagination, or did I see Miss Ida Dozier on the midnight streetcar the other night, headed out to Ensley to Tuxedo Junction for a few dances with Benny Upshaw, only to see her ride home with Mr. G.T. Williams? We must have two or three Birmingham boys in every one of the popular bands around the country, thanks to the expert musicianship of our beloved Professor Fess Squatley. We are well received on the music scene. Don't forget our old friend Cab Calloway is due to grace our magic city soon. Fine fare over at the Frolic Theater this week. Monday through Thursday, a 5-star program. Erskine Hawkins, the 20th Century Gabriel, in Deviled Hams. Also, all-colored sports reel. Rose Terrace Nursing Home, Old Montgomery Highway, Birmingham, Alabama, March 2, 1986. Eating a cup of vanilla ice cream with a wooden spoon, Mrs. Threadgood was reminiscing to Evelyn about the Depression. A lot of people died, one way or the other. It hit hard, especially the colored, who never did have much to begin with. Sipsy said that half the people over there in Troutville would have froze or starved to death if it hadn't been for Railroad Bill. This was a new name to Evelyn. Who was Railroad Bill? Mrs. Threadgood seemed surprised. Didn't I ever tell you about Railroad Bill? No, I don't believe you have. Well, he was a famous bandit. They say he was a colored man that would sneak on the trains and throw food and coal off the government supply trains at night, and the colored people that lived along the tracks would come and get the stuff at daybreak and run home with it as fast as they could. I don't believe they ever did catch him. Never did find out who he was. Grady Kilgore, who was a railroad detective friend of Iggy's, used to come in the cafe every day, and Iggy would laugh and say, "I hear old Railroad Bill is still on the loose. What's the matter with you boys?" He used to get so mad. They must have put 20 extra men on the trains at one time or another, and they offered a lifetime pass on the L&N Railroad to whoever had information about him to come forth. But nobody did. Iggy just razzed him to death over that one. But they were always good friends. He was in that dill pickle club. That what? Mrs. Threadgood laughed. The Dill Pickle Club, the crazy club Iggy and Grady and Jack Butts started. What kind of a club was it?
Well, they claimed it was a breakfast and social club, but it was really just a bunch of Iggy's ragtag friends that would all get together, she and some of the railroad men and Eva Bates and Smokey Lonesome. About all they did was drink whiskey and make up lies. They look you right in the eye and tell you a lie when the truth would have served them better. That was their fun, making up tales. Crazy tales. One time, Ruth had just come in from church, and Iggy was sitting around with them, and she said, "Ruth, I'm sorry to have to tell you this, but while you were gone, Stump swallowed a .22 caliber bullet." When Ruth got all excited, Iggy said, "Don't worry, he's just fine. I just took him over to Doc Hadley's, and he gave him a half a bottle of castor oil and said it was all right to bring him home, but just be careful not to point him at anyone."
Evelyn laughed. Mrs. Threadgood said,
"Well, you can imagine that Ruth didn't care much for the idea of that club. Iggy was the president, and she was always calling secret meetings. Cleo said those secret meetings were nothing more than hot poker games. But he said the club did some good things, but they would never tell you about it if they did. They deny it every time. They didn't care anything about the Baptist preacher, Reverend Scroggins, 'cause he was a teetotaler. And every time some poor fool would ask where he could buy whiskey or live bait, they'd send him over to the preacher's house. Like to have driven him crazy."
Sipsy was the only colored member, because she could tell lies right along with the rest of them. She told them about this woman she was helping who was having trouble giving birth, and how she gave her a tablespoon of snuff, and she said that woman sneezed so hard that she shot that baby clear across the end of the bed and into the other room.
Evelyn said, "Oh, no."
"Oh, yes. Then she told them this tale about her friend Lizzie over in Troutville that was expecting a baby and started craving starch. Said that Lizzie took to eating it right out of the box by the handfuls, and sure enough, when that baby came, it was white as snow and stiff as a board."
"Oh, for heaven's sake."
"But you know, Evelyn, that could have been true. I know for a fact some of those colored women ate clay right out of the ground."
"I can't believe that."
"Well, honey, that's what I heard. Or maybe it was sticks of chalk. I forget which one. But it was either clay or chalk."
Evelyn shook her head, smiling at her friend.
"Oh, Mrs. Threadgood, you are funny."
Mrs. Threadgood thought about it and was pleased with herself and said, "Well, yes, I guess I am at that."
The Weems Weekly, Whistle Stop Alabama's Weekly Bulletin, December 1, 1938. Snow comes to Whistle Stop. What a treat for us, real snow. Whistle Stop could have passed for the North Pole. Is there anything prettier than seeing the red holly bushes covered with snow? I think not, but thank heavens it only snows once every 10 years. My other half, who thinks he can drive in any sort of weather, was determined to take his old hunting dogs for a ride and skidded into a ditch on First Street. So the little lady you see bumming a ride for the next month, until we can get the car fixed, will be me. Yes, my other half is the same one who went for a ride when we had that hailstorm, with hail as big as baseballs, and it took us 3 weeks to get the windshield replaced. He's the same one that got struck by lightning fishing down on the river in a rowboat. So the next time you see bad weather coming and you see Wilbur, send him home, and I'm going to put him in a closet and lock him up. I'm afraid a tornado is liable to pick him up and take him on off somewhere. Then who would I have to fight with?
I hear through the grapevine that Railroad Bill has hit 5 trains in 1 week. I ran into Gladys Kilgore over at the beauty shop, and she says that her husband Grady, who works for the railroad, is hopping mad. By the way, if Railroad Bill reads this, how about throwing a brand new car off one of those trains before Grady catches you? I need one. Dot Weems.
Whistle Stop Cafe, Whistle Stop, Alabama, December 1st, 1938. The sun had just come up behind the cafe, and Iggy shook him awake, shouting, "Get up, Stump! Get up! Look!" She pulled him to the window to look out. The entire field was covered with white. His mouth flew open. "What is it?" Iggy laughed. "It's snow!"
"It is?"
"Yes." He was in the third grade, and this was the first time in his life he had ever seen real snow. Ruth came up behind them in her nightgown and looked out, just as surprised. All three of them got dressed as fast as they could and were out in the yard 5 minutes later. It was only 2 inches deep, but they rolled in it and made snowballs. You could hear the doors opening all over town and children shouting with excitement. By 7 o'clock that morning, Stump and Iggy had already built a short, fat snowman, and Ruth made them snow ice cream with milk and sugar. Iggy decided to walk Stump to school, and as they looked up the railroad tracks, there was nothing but white for as far as they could see. Stump was still so excited, he was jumping around and fell twice. Iggy decided to tell him a story to calm him down. "Did I ever tell you the time me and Smokey played poker with Pig Iron Sam?"
"No. Who's Pig Iron Sam?"
"You mean to tell me you never heard of Pig Iron, the meanest poker player in Alabama?"
"No, ma'am."
"Well, me and Smokey were sitting in this all-night poker game over in Gate City, and I started winning. I guess I won every pot for an hour or so, and Pig Iron was getting madder and madder. But what could I do? I couldn't quit, not while I was winning like that. That's not etiquette. And the more I won, the madder he got. And pretty soon he was in a rage and pulled this gun out and put it on the table and said that he was going to kill the next man that dealt him a bad hand." Stump was totally engrossed by this time.
"Whose turn was it to deal?"
"Well, that's the irony of it. He forgot it was his turn, and lo and behold, he dealt his own self a pair of twos. So he just picked up the gun and shot himself to death right there at the table. A man of his word to the end."
"Wow. Did you see it?"
"Sure I did. It was a pair of twos, big as life." Stump was thinking it over when he spied something sticking out of the snow beside the track. He ran over and picked it up.
"Look, Aunt Iggy, it's a can of Deer Brand sauerkraut, and it hasn't even been opened."
Then it hit him like a ton of bricks. He held the can up with awe and whispered,
"Aunt Iggy, I'll bet this is one of the cans that Railroad Bill threw off the train. Do you think it is?"
Iggy examined the can. "It could be, son. It very well could be. Put it back where you found it, so the folks that are supposed to find it will." Stump placed the can back down on the exact place he'd found it, like it was a sacred thing.
Wow.
His first snow, and now a tin can that could have been from Railroad Bill. It was all too much. They continued walking, and after a few minutes, Stump said,
"I guess that Railroad Bill is about the bravest man that ever lived, huh, Aunt Iggy?"
"He's brave, all right."
"Don't you think he's the bravest man we know of in our whole lives?"
Iggy thought.
"Well, now, I wouldn't say the bravest person I know. I don't think I'd say that. One of the bravest, but not the bravest.
Stump was taken aback.
Who could be braver than Railroad Bill?
Big George? Our Big George?
Yeah. What'd he ever do?
Well, for one thing, I wouldn't be here if it hadn't been for him.
You mean here today?
No, I mean here at all. I would have been eaten up by hogs.
Are you serious?
Yes, sir. When I was about 2 or 3, I guess, me and Buddy and Julian were all hanging around the hog pens, and I climbed up on the fence and fell head first right into the hog trough.
You did?
I did. Well, those hogs all started running over towards me. You know a hog will eat anything. They've been known to eat lots of babies.
Really?
Sure. Anyway, I jumped out of the trough and started running, but I fell down, and they almost had me before I could get out, when Big George saw me and jumped in that pen right in the middle of those hogs and started knocking them out of the way. Now, I'm talking about 300-pound hogs. He would grab them and sling them across the pen one by one like they were sacks of potatoes. He was able to keep them off me long enough for Buddy to crawl onto the fence and pull me out.
Really?
Really. Did you ever notice those scars on Big George's arms?
Yeah.
Well, that's where those hogs bit him. But Big George never said a word to Papa because he knew Papa would kill Buddy for bringing me down there.
I never knew that.
I know you didn't.
Wow. Do you know any other brave people? What about Uncle Julian shooting that 12-point deer last week? That took a lot of courage.
Well, now, there's courage and then there's courage, Iggy said. You don't have to be too brave to shoot some poor dumb animal with a 20-gauge shotgun.
Who else do you know that's brave besides Big George?
Well, let's see, she said, musing. Besides Big George, I'd have to say that your mother was one of the bravest people I know.
Mama?
Yes, your mama.
Oh, I don't believe that. Why, she's scared of everything, even a little bug.
What did she ever do?
Something. She did something once.
What?
It doesn't matter what. You asked me and I told you. Your mother and Big George are the two bravest people I know.
Really?
I promise you so.
Stump was amazed.
Well, I'll be.
That's right. And there's something else I want you always to remember. There are magnificent beings on this earth, son, that are walking around posing as humans. And I don't ever want you to forget that. You hear me?
Stump looked at her sincerely and said,
No, ma'am, I won't.
As they continued on down the tracks, a bright red cardinal swooped out of a snow-covered tree and made a Christmas flight across the white horizon. Rose Terrace Nursing Home, Old Montgomery Highway, Birmingham, Alabama, March 9, 1986. Before, during those long, endless black nights when Evelyn had been awake, sweating with fear and fighting visions of death and tubes and tumors growing, she had wanted to scream out for help while Ed slept beside her. But she had just lain there, in that dark pit of her own personal hell until morning. Lately, to get her mind off that cold gun and pulling the trigger, she would close her eyes and force herself to hear Mrs. Threadgood's voice, and if she breathed deep and concentrated, she would soon see herself in Whistlestop. She would walk down the street and go in Opal's beauty shop and could actually feel her hair being washed with warm water, then cool, then cooler. After a comb out, she would stop by to visit with Dot Weems at the post office, and then on to the cafe, where she could see everyone so clearly, Stump and Ruth and Iggy. She would order lunch, and Wilbur Weems and Grady Kilgore would wave to her. Sipsy and Anzel would smile at her, and she could hear the radio from the kitchen. Everyone would ask her how she was, and the sun was always shining, and there would always be a tomorrow. Lately, she slept more and more, and thought of the gun less and less. When she woke this morning, Evelyn realized that she was actually looking forward to going to the nursing home. Sitting there all these weeks listening to stories about the cafe and whistle stop had become more of a reality than her own life with Ed in Birmingham. When she arrived, her friend was in a good mood, as usual, and was happy to get the Hershey bar without almonds, a special request. Halfway through it, Mrs. Threadgood was busy wondering about a hobo she had known years ago. "Lord, I wonder whatever happened to Smoky Lonesome. It's no telling where he is now. Probably dead somewhere, I guess." "I remember the first time he ever came in the cafe. I was having a plate of fried green tomatoes, and he knocked on the back door looking for food. Iggy went in the kitchen, and pretty soon she came back in with this poor fella that was filthy dirty from riding the rails, and told him to go into the bathroom and wash up, and she'd give him a bit to eat. Iggy went to fix him a plate and said that was the lonesomest-looking character she'd ever seen. He said his name was Smoky Phillips, but Iggy named him Smoky Lonesome. And after that, every time she'd see him coming in off the road, she'd say, 'Here comes old Smoky Lonesome.' Poor old thing. I don't think he had a family, and Ruth and Iggy felt sorry for him, 'cause he was about half dead, and let him stay in that old shack they had out in back of the cafe. Oh, he'd get the wanderlust every once in a while and take off two or three times a year, but sooner or later he'd show back up, usually drunk and run down, and he'd go out back in his shed and stay a while. He never owned a thing in his life. All he had was a knife and a fork and a spoon that he carried inside his coat pocket, and this can opener that he kept in his hat band. Said he didn't want to be burdened down. I think that shed out back was the only place he ever had to call home, and if it hadn't been for Ruth and Iggy, he might have starved to death. But I think the real reason he kept coming back was because he was in love with Ruth. He never said so, but you could tell by the way he looked at her. You know, I'm thankful that my Cleo passed on first. It seems like a man can't live without a woman. That's why most of them die right after their wives do. They just get lost. It's pitiful. You take old man Dunaway, who's out here. His wife hasn't even been dead over a month yet, and he's already started goosing all the women. That's why they're giving him those tranquilizers, to calm him down. Thinks he's a Romeo. Can you imagine? And you should see what he looks like, just like an old turkey buzzard with big floppy ears and all. But who am I to say? No matter what you look like, there's somebody who's gonna think you're the handsomest man in the world. Well, maybe he'll catch one of these old women yet. West Madison Street, Chicago, Illinois, December 3, 1938. West Madison Street, Chicago, was no different from Pratt Street in Baltimore, South Main Street in Los Angeles, or Third Street in San Francisco, a street of gospel missions, cheap rooming houses and hotels, second-hand clothes stores, greasy spoon soup lines, pawn shops, liquor stores, and whorehouses, teeming with what were kindly referred to as disappointed men. The only thing that made that year in Chicago different from any other was that Smokey Lonesome, who usually traveled alone, had picked up a friend. Just a kid, really, but he was company. They'd met over a month ago in Michigan. He was a good-looking, fresh-faced kid, wearing a thin blue-gray slip-over sweater over a brown frayed shirt and ragged brown pants, with skin like a baby's ass. Still wet behind the ears, he'd had a lot of trouble over in Detroit with guys trying to bugger him, and he'd asked Smokey if he could travel with him for a while. Smokey had told him the same thing that an old guy once said, "Go home now, kid, while you can. Get away from this life, 'cause once you piss out of a boxcar, you're hooked."